Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. This is John H. from Serenity Seekers in Flemington, New Jersey.
I'm John, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jeff, for asking me to speak. You know, I think that's right where I'm going to start. It's a miracle to me to be standing up here tonight and being able to tell you a little bit about myself and how I stay sober. I found a spiritual solution to my drinking problem, and it's this fellowship, and it's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact that I don't have to take a drink today is just an amazing thing, because it was the last thing that I ever really wanted. I wanted to drink myself to death. In fact, I wanted to drink myself to death twice. It was not my intention to come in here. It was not my intention to get sober. But my higher power intervened through a member of this fellowship and dragged me kicking and screaming to a hospital 3 years ago this coming Friday. So I'm able to stand here and tell you how I did it. Before I do this, I always say a little prayer that something I say helps somebody in this room. So listen up, it might be you. I have a sobriety date of April 24th, 2007. I have a previous sobriety date of May 28th, 1981. I would stay sober for 19 and a half years before I found it necessary to pick up a drink again. The reason why I found it necessary to pick up a drink again is I stopped doing this. And I stopped identifying myself as an alcoholic. I stopped saying my name is John and I'm an alcoholic. I forgot who I was. There's a little bit more to it that I'll get into. But once I left this fellowship, I was destined to pick up a drink again. I came in when I was 25. And it would be almost 25 years to the day that I ended up in exactly the same place, almost dead from this disease. My story is it ain't all that much fun like most of our stories. So I'm going to preface it or start with where I'm at today. My life is so good today. It's beyond my wildest dreams. It's because I have this fellowship and I have a higher power in my life, and I can be of service as much as I want. There's a lot of alcoholics out there that need all of our help, and so I put my hand out a lot. I get a lot of gratitude out of that. It seems to keep my head on straight. Beyond that, I can take care of my own life today. I can work, I can make plans, I can have good relationships. I can look to the future, and I can look to a sober future. I'm pretty sure that I'm going to be sober tomorrow because I'm going to do exactly the same thing tomorrow that I'm doing today. And that works for me. So I picked up my first drink when I was 12. I'm 54 now. In those 42 years, I'd be sober about 22 and a half years, and I'd be drunk the rest of the time. The time that I was sober, except for 2 years, I participated fully in this fellowship. The time that I got drunk, I didn't. And it's that simple for me. I know that I need to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I need to work the 12 steps. I know I need to put my hand out. I know I need to do these types of things. So I'm eternally grateful to all of you to let me stand here tonight. My whole life has centered around alcohol, either drinking or staying sober. All of my years have been around that. My earliest memories when I was 4 or 5 years old were of alcohol. I was always fascinated with people that drank. The people I looked up to in my family were the drunks. There was many of them. I come from a long line of unsuccessful drunks. And I loved every one of them. The ones that didn't, I never warmed up to them. When I was a kid, my heroes weren't necessarily sport heroes, although I liked Mickey Mantle because I knew that he drank a lot. But it was people out in the media that drank. And I thought, and to this day, I think the greatest comedian is W.C. Fields. Not because he's so terribly funny, because he played a good drunk, and I loved it. I loved watching him, even when I was a little kid. So I come from a middle class, maybe upper middle class background. I'm one of six. We had basically everything we needed. I have parents that I know love me. And I was an angry little turd. I was born restless, irritable, and discontent. I hated my life, and there was no reason for it. I understand now why, mostly because I'm insane. So I could not wait, and I still am. Actually, I had a discussion coming up here about insanity. I'm not insane today. I have a program that keeps me sober, but I am a little bit nuts. My whole life, I couldn't wait till I was old enough to start drinking, and I became old enough when I was 12 years old. That drink was alcoholic in that I stole a couple of beers from my father. I shared it with this little girl down the street. My mother had the nose of a bloodhound from across the house. She smelled the beer. I got caught. I got my ass kicked. I was told I could never see that little girl again, and I could never steal alcohol again. I saw that little girl a couple days later, and I stole some beer a couple days later. I would always pay the price. It would always be a consequence to my drinking. But I never thought that maybe I shouldn't. I didn't care. Right from the beginning, once I took those couple of beers, I just couldn't wait to do it again. And I did it pretty quick. Within a couple of weeks, I did the same thing. And I got caught again. I got my father did not spare the rod. But I just kept going. Within a year, I was getting drunk on a weekly basis. By the time I was 14, it was more than that. And when you think about a 14-year-old, how he's going to get alcohol, I couldn't do it legally. I had to steal it, or I had to steal the money to get it. And I didn't care. I wasn't brought up that way. I wasn't brought up to think that it was okay to steal, that it was okay to kick people's doors in and steal their TV and sell it for 20 bucks so I could buy a case of beer. But if there was alcohol at the end of it, I would do anything to do it. And I did. By the time I was 15 years old, I was getting drunk in school. One of the ways that I supported my habit was I'd make whiskey sour mixes at home. I'd bring it into school, and I'd sell it out of my locker for 50 cents a glass. I was an alcohol pusher. I see a lot of you shaking your head. I think you're recognizing the insanity, not how brilliant that was. And it was totally insane. And it wouldn't be until I sobered up that I realized that was really nuts. And all the other things that I did, all the antisocial things that I did, I had a reputation of being the drunk in my high school, and I loved that reputation. It didn't hurt me at all. I wanted people to think of me as that wild kid who loved to get drunk and would do just about anything. And it wouldn't be until I sobered up that I looked at that. So I got into all the trouble that an active alcoholic can get into during high school. And I started turning my back on things that were important. I was a pretty good athlete when I was younger. At one point, this is when the Mets were pretty lousy, but I had a Mets scout watching me. I was a golfer and a wrestler and a football player and all those things. And I was fair at them, at least. Once I was 15 years old, I just didn't care anymore. All that I wanted to do was to get drunk. I should mention there's drugs in my store. I probably tried every drug there is out there. But I loved getting drunk. I just loved it. So by the time I was 18, I think I was 18, I was still a junior in high school, but they asked me to leave. They just said they couldn't handle me anymore. I was spending most of my time in detention for being drunk or doing something else that I shouldn't be doing. So I left high school and I started this little construction business, which is a perfect business for an alcoholic because I could work a couple of days or a couple of weeks and make a stash of money and then not work until it was all gone and do it all over again. I got arrested for stealing a car. I almost forgot what it was. And the judge said to me that I could either stay where I was or I could go to Carrier Clinic. So I decided to go to Carrier Clinic, and I did my 28 days down there. And a few significant things happened. I found out that I was an alcoholic. I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. And I knew that I was way too young to do anything about it. I thought that maybe when I'm 50 years old, that's when I'll stop drinking, but not now. So here I am 50 years old and I stopped drinking. I lasted about 2 weeks. I don't even count this as a time in recovery, because I didn't give a damn. You know, I went to a couple of AA meetings. I lasted 2 weeks. I was way too young. I picked up a drink again, and I would last about 6 years. Very quickly, or at that point, I was a daily drinker. My days consisted of waking up whenever I woke up, drink enough to get out the door and make a couple of bucks so I could get home at night and drink some more. When I wasn't doing that, I was just drinking around the clock and not doing anything else but that. My health was starting to fail. My relationships had failed. There was really nobody left in my life that wanted anything to do with me, including my family. By the age of 25, I was a 24/7 drunk that couldn't do anything else. My last drunk ended up, I was at the Greenbrook Motel on Route 22 in Greenbrook, New Jersey, which was an $8 a night place. Real fancy place. And I was there about 2 weeks. My days consisted of just staying drunk. I'd wake up whenever I'd wake up, and I'd shiver and shake until 9:05, until the liquor store across the street opened. And I'd scurry across the Route 22, trying not to get killed. I'd get two bottles of vodka, 2 6-packs of beer, and scurry across Route 22, come into my room, close the door, pull the shades. I'd look down, I'd sigh, and I'd be so happy because I had my friends and my God with me, and that's all I needed. And I spent 2 weeks like that, not eating, just drinking constantly. I was at the point where I'd throw up blood in my first couple of drinks. I could not control my bodily functions. Excuse me for being so gross, but it's the truth. And I still didn't think that anything was wrong with me. As long as I could get those 2 bottles of vodka and 2 6-packs of beer and get back into my room and close the door and pull the shades, I had everything that I wanted. And if I could have kept going, I would have kept going. I never had a thought that maybe I should stop drinking. I never had a thought that maybe this might kill me. I didn't care. The only thing that stopped me is I ran out of money. I didn't have the $8 for the room, and I had no place to go. So I called up Mommy and Daddy, crying, tell them I needed some help. I needed a place to go. And they said they'd take me home, but on one condition, I had to go to rehab. And since I had no choice, I did. I went to Runnels ARU in Berkeley Heights. It's no longer there. It's a nursing home. They had a pretty good program back then. They were focused on AA. They held AA meetings there in the hospital, and they took you out into the community. And folks like you came in and put your hand out to me. I met my first sponsor, Jimmy G. He was an incredible man. And I started... let me backtrack because it gets significant. When I came into that hospital, I was in such terrible physical shape. My blood pressure was sky high. My skin color was yellow. And they were concerned whether they could keep me there or send me down the street to Overlook Hospital. They were just afraid that I was going to stroke out at the age of 25. Their solution to that was that they assigned a nurse to watch me. I realize now it was 8 hours a day, and another one came on, but this man impressed me so much. I thought he was there 24/7 for me. He was a giant. He was at least 8 foot tall, and he was the gentlest person I've ever met in my life. And for some reason, he made me feel like he cared about me. And for most of my life, I didn't think anybody cared about me. I thought the only care that I could get was going to be out of a bottle. So he stood by me. He made sure I didn't stroke out. He snuck me a couple of cigarettes here and there. And I did the 28-day program. I got introduced to AA again. I started going to meetings, and my sponsor started talking to me. But it sucked. I really hated it. I hated being sober. I hated being 25 and being sober. I hated the idea that I had to go to meetings. I hated the idea that people were telling me I needed to find God. I hated just to be myself. Needless to say, I hadn't had much surrender yet. That would happen after about 6 months of this fighting. I constantly wanted to have a drink. I don't know how I didn't drink in those 6 months. I'd find myself driving to a meeting, and all of a sudden I'd be in a liquor store parking lot just praying to get me out of there and let me get to a meeting. And somehow my higher power did get me out of there and got me to a meeting. To this day, I remember where I was about 6 months in. I was at a Westfield Friday night meeting. I remember who was speaking. What he's saying was not important, but a feeling came over me. At the time, I thought it was out of nowhere. Now I know it was out of God. That I wanted to stay sober, that I wanted what this program offered. I wanted the life that I saw you people displaying for me. And I prayed. I prayed to just show me how to do this. Within a few days, another gentleman came in my life, Bob Hahn, who's passed on now. And I asked him to be my sponsor. My first sponsor, Jimmy G., he was a good man. He didn't work the steps. He didn't expect me to work the steps, and I wasn't getting anywhere without the steps. Jimmy G did not die sober. He picked up a few years after that. An incredible man, but I think he drank again because he didn't have a program of recovery, and I don't want that for myself. So Bob took me through the steps pretty quick. He sat me down. He got to know me. He had me tell him my story, the story I just told you. And he says, "You think you're powerless over alcohol?" I said, "Gee, I don't know." He said, "Tell me your story again." I said, "Yeah, I guess you're right." He said, "Do you think your life is unmanageable?" I said, "Well, that's a real tough one. I don't, you know, what do you mean about by that? My life is unmanageable." I said, I do what I have to do." He said, "Do you remember what you used to do in your pants back in that motel?" I said, "I guess my life is unmanageable too, Bob." He says, Do you think that there's something wrong with your thinking? Do you think you're a little crazy?" And I said, "Yeah, I do, Bob. I think I'm really insane, and I don't know what the hell I can do about it." He says, "Have you looked around the rooms?" I said, "Yeah, I've looked around the rooms. I've seen people." He says, "Do you think they have been restored to sanity?" I says, "Yeah, most of them." "Well, not most of them, some of them." And he said, "The ones that you think have been restored to sanity, how'd they do it?" I think, "Well, I guess they found a higher power to do that." And he said, "Do you really believe that?" And I had to think about it for a while. In fact, that's when we took a break. And a few days later, I said, "Bob, I really do believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. But how do I do it? How does that happen?" And he said, "You need to remove the blocks that are keeping you from a relationship with God and those about you." And I said, "Okay, that sounds really great, Bob. How do I do that?" He says, "You need to take an inventory." I didn't think that I could do that. I really didn't think that I could do that. And that's what I told him. I thought that I had so many deep, dark secrets, and I was such a horrible, horrible person that I could not tell anybody all these things that I did. All those years while I was out there. But he said, "You need to do it. You need to do it if you're going to stay sober." He said, "Do you want to stay sober?" I said, "Yeah, I do, Bob." So we started working on a fourth step, and I started writing down these things. What I realized, and I realize it even deeper today, that these things that I did, this personality that I created, this antisocial personality that I created, was solely there so I could live the life of an alcoholic, so I could live the life of a thief. And I needed to create that person, but it wasn't who I was. It would take me a long time to realize that I wasn't that person. That doesn't mean that I didn't have to take responsibility for those things that I did, but that wasn't me. So I did a fourth step, and he invited me over to his house with his beautiful wife, Hattie. He said, "We're going to sit down and we're going to talk about this. You're going to tell me everything. You're going to be honest. And then we'll see where you're going to go from there." So I sat down and I told him this long story of my life, how I was the baddest dude out there, all these terrible, terrible things that I did. And I thought he was going to be shocked and probably throw me out of his house before we got to dinner. I can still see him sitting there, sitting in his big chair. He says, man, you're a lightweight. And it had the desired effect. I went from being this big to being down to size. I was no longer that badass dude that was going to control everything by my behavior. He allowed me to see that who I was, who I had created, was not who I was inside. It was an amazing experience. It was humiliating, but it also taught me a lot about humility. And there's a big difference between humiliation and humility. Humility is knowing who I am. Humiliation is something else again. Humiliation is something that will send me back to a drink. I don't allow much humiliation in my life today. So I laid all these things out to him. I told him all about it. He said, "You're a lightweight." He said, "But you can't get rid of them on your own." He said, "You need to ask God to take them away." I thought that was insane. I said, why would God want to take these things away from you? He says, because he needs you to help another alcoholic. And I think that was the first time I got how this thing really works. You know, it wasn't about me coming in and drinking the coffee and eating the donuts and complaining about how my life is. It was about me making myself fit to be of service to God knows about me. And it was the first time I realized that, and it was the first time I started working a real program of recovery. So I got down on my knees, and I said, "Dear God, please take these things that are keeping me away from being service to you." And he didn't do anything about it. He didn't take one of them away. But I would work through it, and I can say that eventually some of those things were taken away from me. I made a list of all these people that I had harmed, and there was a lot of them. Most of them were family. Some of them were, a good deal of them were financial. Some of them were government institutions. Some of them were judges. But I put them all down, and I started on these 9-step amends. And almost to an amends, they were positive. People said it was okay what I did, and that they wanted the best for me. What was important for me, and this is what Bob taught me and what inspiration I got from a higher power, was that before I walked up to somebody and said, "I'm sorry that I took your wallet out of your back pocket," that I was sure that I was never going to do it again before I said it. Or when I said to a family member, "I'm sorry that you had to live in fear of me for all those years because of my behavior," that I was sure that I wouldn't do that again before I made the amends. And it took a while for me to get to that point where I felt relatively secure that I wouldn't do that. But I think that's why the amends at that point were very well taken, because they could see it in me that I had changed. I had done some work. And I had been sober a little bit. So he impressed on me that the need to take a daily inventory, to sit down at the end of the day and look at my behavior and what I could do about that. And if my behavior seemed like it was getting to be more unmanageable, that I need to be very careful, because if my life is getting unmanageable again, I'm sure as hell going to take a drink again. And that was the most important thing that I was getting out of a step 10, especially early on. Is my life manageable or is it not? And if it's not manageable, I need to do something about it immediately or I'm going to get drunk. So I found a way to help me keep my life a little bit more manageable, and that was through prayer and meditation. Now, I was brought up Roman Catholic. I have nothing against the Roman Catholics. But at the time, I was brought up to fear God, and I could not accept that. And since you told me that I needed to find a God of my understanding, I started this spiritual search of for God and what that meant for me. But I started with prayer. And it was simple prayers. It was, "Dear God, show me what you're about." And I started seeing that. I started looking around. My eyes became opened a little bit. I started seeing people being kind to me and putting their hand out to me and realizing that was an act of God. And I started doing it myself, and it felt good, and it kept my awareness of being a compassionate person. I started to meditate first, how it talks about in the big book, which isn't all that extensive, but it's a start. And then I started studying with other people in different ways of meditating. And so over the years, I deepened my understanding of a higher power and what that means to me and how I can express that in the world. And that, besides my sobriety, my daily prayer and meditation became the most important thing in my life. And if there's one thing or one aspect of this program, besides the 12 steps that kept me sober for 19 and a half years, it was that. It was a daily contact with a higher power. So I practiced step 11 on a daily basis, and I spent an awful lot of time trying to understand what God was to me. And I traveled all over the world. I was lucky enough to be able to do that, and studied with a lot of incredible people, and a few insane people too. But I got something that worked for me, and I got something that I was able to offer other people. And so I would do that for the next 19 and a half years. I would also do everything else that the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous told me I needed to do to stay sober. I would do this, go out on speaking commitments. I'd speak all over New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and I loved it. I love the program. I do everything else. Back then, you could smoke in the meeting, and I've cleaned thousands and thousands of ashtrays. Bob Hahn told me that your sobriety is underneath that ashtray, so go looking for it. And I did a lot of ashtray diving, but it kept me sober and putting chairs out and making coffee, chairing meetings, sponsoring an awful lot of guys. I've been blessed over the years with having wonderful people to sponsor to this day. So I did all that, you know. For 15 years, I was going to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 meetings a week, even after 15 years. My life was good, my business was good, my relationships were great. After about 3 years in the program, I had a wonderful day. I met this woman in another 12-step program, and we got married. And 7 years later, I had an even more wonderful day. I got divorced. But all in sobriety. I didn't get drunk over it, and she didn't do what she did over it. And we were able to end that amicably. So my life was good. And it was good because of my spiritual condition and my participation in this fellowship on a daily basis. After about 15 years, this little insidious no started coming into my life, and people would say, "You want to go out to Quaker Town and speak?" And I'd say, "Nah, it's kind of a drive. Maybe I'll not do that." Or somebody would ask me if I wanted a sponsor, I'd say, "You know, I got a lot of guys that I'm sponsoring right now. Why don't you get somebody else?" Or people would say, "Why don't you go pick up that stinky ashtray right there and dump it?" And I'd say, "No, let somebody younger do that." People would ask me to make coffee or chair a meeting. And my answer more and more became, no, I don't need to do that. I've done that a lot over the years. I'm very busy. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I'm very important. I don't need to do that. It took about 2 years in no's until I had no more no's left, and I completely removed myself from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not need to go to meetings anymore. I didn't need to help anybody. I didn't need to be of service. I didn't need to keep myself fit to be of service to God knows about me, because I was now God again. I was responsible for how good my life had become. I was responsible for my sobriety. I didn't need any of you. I didn't need God. But I continued to pray and meditate, and God was important in my life. Except I believed I was praying to myself and not to anything greater than myself. So that would last about 2.5 years without going to meetings, without saying my name is John, I'm an alcoholic, without reaching my hand out to another alcoholic. And I realized after I came back, the most devastating part of not coming to meetings was that I had no place to go to share my sobriety. And that's the main reason why I picked up a drink again. So I picked up that drink again. I wasn't thinking about drinking. It wasn't a bad day or a bad week or a bad year. In fact, my life better. I was on the Big Island of Hawaii at the end of a nice long trip. The people that I traveled with had gone home, and I was going to one of my favorite Italian restaurants in this little town called Pahoa in the jungle on the east end of Big Island. I sat down, I ordered a veal parmesan, a side of spaghetti, and a Heineken. And I didn't think twice about it. I didn't think twice about it before I ordered it. It just came out of my mouth. It was the most natural thing in the world. I had everything else. There's no reason why I can't have a drink. So I had that Heineken, and it was outstanding. And I had another one, and that was even more outstanding. And that's all I had. I paid my bill. I went home to this little house I was renting, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. I had everything I wanted, and now I could drink again, too. So the next day, my biggest problem was whether I should drink wine or beer. So I bought a bottle of wine and a six-pack of beer. I did not drink all the wine or all the beer. In fact, that night I had a couple of glasses of wine. I put it down. I can still see myself sitting on the back deck on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, thinking how wonderful this is that I can now drink. I can drink like a gentleman. It never dawned on me that a social drinker would never think how incredible it was to take a drink. They would just go ahead and have a drink. But I was feeling pretty good about the fact that I could now have two drinks with impunity, nothing happened. And I couldn't wait to do it again. And so I did the next night. I stayed on Big Island for a little while longer, and I came back to New Jersey. And life continued to be good, and I continued to drink. And in a somewhat non-alcoholic way, in that I just have a couple and put it down. I can now entertain customers at lunch with it, not just a hamburger. I could have a couple of beers with them. And at night, I could have a couple of more beers and go to bed. Again, thinking how wonderful it is that I can drink again and how unsociable that thought is. So this lasted about 3 months. And I'm going through this drinking phase, just feeling wonderful about myself. I thought I was the first alcoholic to ever become a social drinker. and I really believed it. Until one day, I wasn't feeling so good in the morning. It was about 8:41 in the morning, not in the evening. And I said, you know, I think a beer would make me feel pretty good. And why not? I know I can handle it. So I did. I had my first morning beer in almost 20 years. Within a few days, I was drinking around the clock. Within a few days, I didn't give a rat's behind about anything else but taking another drink. It would take about 6.5 years before I ended up exactly that same place I was when I was 25 years old, except I wasn't at the Greenbrook Motel. I was in my house that I would soon lose because I couldn't pay the bills anymore. I was drinking around the clock. I had stopped eating. My days began by shivering and shaking until 9:05 till I could get down to the local liquor store, get my two bottles of vodka, my two six-packs of beer, closing the door and feeling pretty good because I got my friends and my God right here for the rest of the day. And that's how my life was, and that's all that I cared about 6.5 years later, was just that I could keep it going. And could I get to the liquor store again tomorrow? Or was there enough alcohol to make it to the next day? In those horrible, horrible days when I drink a little bit too much and I'd be out by 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning knowing there's no way I can make it to 9 o'clock. No way that I can make it to 9 o'clock, and shivering and shaking. The auditory hallucinations that I had, I heard all kinds of things going on in this house, and I felt all kinds of critters crawling over me, snakes and bugs and everything else. And somehow, I'd get down to that liquor store at 9:05, shivering and shaking. And Rick never once asked, "Are you sure you're okay?" He just said, $25.54, whatever it was. And he was happy to take my money. I made a few attempts at sobering up during those years. maybe I went to a half dozen meetings up in Bloomsbury, and it was usually at the tail end. I get to the point where I just physically could not drink anymore, and I had to detox myself. I didn't realize how dangerous that was, but I'd spend 3, 4, 5, 6 days just shivering and shaking and puking, and not sleeping, not eating, not doing anything until I was calm enough to either go get a drink or go to a meeting. And usually I do both. And my thought process was, I know I need to stay stopped. I can't stop right now after all I've been through this past 4 or 5 days without drinking. But let me have a couple of drinks. I'll go to a meeting, and maybe I'll stop next week. And that one thought almost killed me, because the next thought was that if I'm going to stop next week, I really might as well get drunk tonight. And that kept me going for 6.5 years. 6.5 years later, after I picked up a drink, I was still in the house, but I was going to lose it. I lost my business, I lost my health, I lost all my relationships. To this day, the worst thing that I lost was my dog. And I lost myself completely. And I lost my higher power. The one thing I failed to mention, that 19.5 years, or the two and a half years that I was not going to AA, I was still praying and meditating every day. And my relationship with my higher power was important to me. The day that I took that first drink in Hawaii, I never thought about God again until I came back in this program. I never had one thought. I didn't even have one of those foxhole prayers, "Dear God, get me out of here." I didn't care about God or anything. I just wanted to get drunk. So six and a half years later, I'm shivering and shaking, sitting in my own mess. The house was unbelievable. It looked like a bomb hit it. There was newspapers and empties everywhere. There wasn't a clean stitch of clothes anywhere. There wasn't a clean anything, including me. And I got a call one day from this guy, Jim Kay. He was a member of my sister's church. She called him. She knew he was in AA. She called Jim and said, "You need to get a hold of my brother. He's drinking himself to death. I don't think he has much more time." So he called me up. I talked to him. He knew that I had been in AA before, and I understood what he was saying. And I said, "Jim, I think you're right. I think I need to stop drinking. I need some help. But I need to get... So give me about a week." The only affairs I had was that I still had some money left. I could still buy some more alcohol, and I still wanted to keep drinking. So he called about a week later, and I said, "Jim, I agree with you, but I need to get my affairs in order. Give me a call in about a week." And he said, "John, you don't have another week." He said, "If you keep drinking, you're going to be dead." He said, "I'm coming over." I said, "Please, Jim, don't come over. I'm not ready to stop yet." I still had a couple of beers in the refrigerator, and I still had $300.10. So I knew I had at least a couple of days left. About an hour later, there's a knock on the door. Jim Kay could barely walk. He had some pretty serious problems with his legs. I had drank myself to such a point, and also due to an injury, that I could not walk without using two canes. But somehow, for some reason, I opened the door. I let Jim drag me to the Hunterdon Medical Center. I went into convulsions in the emergency room, and they gave me some Ativan and a couple other things to stop that. And the doctor looked at me and he said, "If you keep drinking, you're going to be dead in 2 days." And I was livid. I was physically incapable of leaving the hospital. But all that I wanted was those 2 days, and I would have gladly left if I could have, and drank those 2 days, and died. That's the insanity of this disease and how it manifested in me. I've seen that in other people, and I think that's how people can drink themselves to death, because you just don't care anymore. And I didn't care. I wanted to do that. By the grace of God and Hunterdon Medical Center, I wasn't allowed to do that. They put me up on the flight deck. A normal stay up on the flight deck is 3 or 4 days. Then you're out. You either get into rehab or someplace else, or you go back on the street. But they don't keep you there long. But again, it was just like I was when I was 25. I could barely walk. They diagnosed me with a bunch of different diseases. My liver was shot. They said I was diabetic. They said you're suffering from depression and general anxiety disorder. They figured that I was a suicide risk. Up there, they have these little stickers that they put next to your name up on the board of things that they need to watch. You got a special diet. You're a fall risk. You're a suicide risk. And I had about 15 of these things next to my name. And I had a nurse follow me around everywhere. I couldn't go to the bathroom without him. I couldn't take a shower. I couldn't do any of these things. I couldn't get close to the second floor window, because even though I could barely walk, they were afraid I was going to throw myself through this plate glass and kill myself. So they kept pulling me away from the windows. After about 4 days, though, something, you know, that same feeling I had at that Westfield meeting on a Friday night, something came over me. And I knew that if I could just get back to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'd be okay. I knew that if I could just get God back into my life, I'd be okay. They didn't think so. My counselor, Kate, every day, I think she worked 8 hours a day every day on my case alone, trying to find a rehab somewhere that would take me, and she couldn't find one. You know, things were getting close. She said, we need to find some place for you. There's no way you can go back out on the street. You'll be drunk within minutes. And I said, Kate, just please let me get out of here. I need to get to an AA meeting and I'll be fine. She says, there's no way. So anyway, besides that and my physical condition, I was there for 13 days. Trying to find some place, a rehab that would take me. They couldn't find a rehab that would take me. And so they tried Hagedorn, which is a mental hospital, which I certainly qualified for, but they wouldn't take me. So they had to let me go. And her speech was at the end, I hope you make it back in here in a few days, because if not, I'll know you're dead. I got out on a Wednesday. Wednesday night, I went to an AA meeting. Somebody saw the condition I was in. His name was Dan. He walked up and shook my hand. He said, things are rough, but why don't you sit down and listen? And I felt so good to be back in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the best day of my life. So I met other men like that and some other women that made me feel welcome, made me feel like I was in the right place. But I was in pretty bad shape. There were people today that come up to me and said, I remember how bad you looked when you came in. And that made me redouble my efforts at Alcoholics Anonymous because of the way you looked. And I said, thanks for letting me be a service. So I went to a lot of meetings. I went to over 200 meetings in the first 90 days because I could do it and because I needed to do it. I still felt pretty bad about myself. You only speak for an hour? That's it? Yeah. I was beating myself up pretty good about how the hell could I do what I did? How could I give away all that was so good in my life just for a drink? And I spent the first couple of months back doing that until I realized that I didn't lose anything. I still had that sober time. I still had what I learned. I still had my relationship with a higher power. I still knew what I needed to do to stay sober. I needed to work a program of recovery, and I had to work the steps. My first sponsor, that gentleman that I just mentioned before, it's interesting how that happened twice. He was not big on the steps, but he gave me to somebody else who was, who actually turned out wasn't that big on the steps either. So I asked somebody else because I knew that I needed to work the steps. If I was going to have any sanity in my life, if I was going to reconnect with God, I needed to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous again, and I found somebody that would help me through that. And so I went through the process again. I looked at what happened the last 6.5 years and how I saw myself scurrying down to the liquor store at 9:05, and I could easily admit that I was powerless over alcohol. And when I saw the wreckage of my very recent past, it was really easy for me to accept that my life was completely unmanageable as a result of my alcoholism. And I knew that God would restore me to sanity. All that I had to do was ask and do the work. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of a higher power that I had a much better understanding this time around than the first time around. I did another fourth and fifth step, And I recognize again that antisocial behavior that I created to allow myself to live the life of an active alcoholic. I asked God to take it away from me. And God said no again. He said, you got to go do the work. And so I did. A daily inventory is a part of my daily life. Prayer and meditation is a part of my daily life. Working on those character defects, the way I do that is I see somebody who's shivering and shaking like I was, and I walk up to him and say, my name is John and I'm an alcoholic, can I help you? And that allows me to cleanse myself of all those antisocial behaviors and create very social behaviors in these rooms. The greatest gift that this fellowship offers me besides sobriety is just that. It's the constant opportunity to be able to be of service to people just like me. I'm blessed to have a bunch of guys that asked me to sponsor them. And I take them through the steps, and I see them go from having that look in their eyes that I had, that dead look, to having that light in their eyes, to being eager to live their life, to being eager to get on with it, to being eager to wake up without having to take a drink or a drug, and to be eager to go help another alcoholic. I think that one of my responsibilities as a sponsor is to sponsor my people, or the people that I sponsor, to become sponsors. That's how this thing works. I take people through the steps right away. I know there's all kinds of different theories about when and how to do the steps. I said when I started this thing, I found a spiritual solution to my drinking problem. That spiritual solution is in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for you, and it's nowhere else. If I'm going to keep that, if I'm going to have anything to give anybody, it has to be the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I do. Once a guy's been around a couple of weeks, it's time to sit down. It's time to sit down, and then it's time to stand up and admit that you're powerless over alcohol, that your life is unmanageable, and get on with the rest of it. I do it in a pretty quick and straightforward way. I don't think the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are complicated. I don't think they were ever meant to be complicated. I think they are as they're laid out in the big book. And most of that is sitting down and reading the big book and having a conversation. Seeing if you understand it, if you get the purpose of this step, and can you take it without any reservations. And then let's move on. You know, we don't need to wallow in it. Again, the fourth and fifth step, to me, the fourth step is about what's keeping me or what's keeping another human being from having a relationship with a higher power and having good relationships with each other. That's what it's for. Remove those barriers, then you can find God and you can stay sober and you can help another alcoholic. So that's how I see that. You know, there's I've created a little bit of controversy where I come from, Flemington, about this. And I'm not going to get into it too much. The only reason I bring that up is that I think we all need to find out what's most important about our own program and then work it and share it with other people. I know that I have. And I'm not afraid to admit it, that I work hard at this program and I work hard at helping another alcoholic. It's the only way that I can stay sober. The last thing that I ever want in my life is to pick up another drink. Except I know how quick my thinking could change on that. Because there was a time in my life when I had many years sober, and I said, give me a veal parmesan, a side of spaghetti, and a Heineken. I'm thinking, I don't ever want to get there again. The only way that I can ensure that I won't get there is by continuing to do what I'm doing now, continuing to work the steps, continuing to help another alcoholic. It says in step 3 in the 12 and 12, which I don't use that much, by the way, that the steps are a continuous process. You know, and I think what we do, what I do in AA, whether it's at a speaker's meeting, whether I'm sharing at a discussion meeting, is not to talk about my problems or how I feel that day or the cat peed on the rug and I feel like taking a drink. It's to share my recovery through the 12 steps so somebody else can hear it and maybe they can stay sober that day. This whole program is geared towards somebody else. I take care of myself and then I give it away. When I do that, my life is great. And my life is great today. I don't like to often read, but I had this thing in my pocket, and I'm going to end with this because this This is what's real for me. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we can never do by ourselves. That's it for me. I want to thank you all for helping me stay sober another day. And Jeff, for letting me come up here.